I was asked to do a 20-minute talk, so I was a little surprised to hear that I'm speaking for 40 minutes. But I suppose that'll leave more time for the questions and comments from the 300 of you to me. So that's something to look forward to later on. Well, it's the start of the Order Weekend. We're celebrating our 40th birthday, so I'm going to start with a joke. And it's Saturday morning, the Sabbath, so it seems fitting to make it a Jewish joke. Thank you. So Benjamin is lying in bed on the Sabbath. His mother comes into the room, she pulls back the curtains, and she says, "Benny, you've got to get up." He says, "I don't want to." "Well, you have to," says his mother. "I don't have to." "Oh, yes, you do," she says. "Why?" "Because you're 40 years old and you're the rabbi." It feels like that sometimes, doesn't it? 40 sounds old. Almost as old, you might say, as that joke. When the Order had its 16th birthday, Bante gave a talk. Some of you may remember it. And he made much of the Order's coming of age. At 40, the analogy is rather less attractive. But let's not dwell on that. For a Buddhist sangha, 40 years is a blink in eternity. All the same, a birthday prompts reflections on who you really are and what's most important to you. So, as Saramati mentioned, for myself, I've been reflecting on the Buddha in recent months while writing a book on his life. The book that Saramati mentioned sounds fascinating. It's not quite the book I'm writing, actually. I'm writing a more standard biography of the Buddha. There he is, sitting on our shrines, perching on a flower in the middle of our refuge tree. But there are so many, sometimes competing, perspectives on the Buddha's life. Historical, canonical, archetypal, transcendental. When I was first asked to write the book, I wondered, as you can imagine, whether there was anything new that I could add to the many books that already exist. So I threw myself into reading some of them. And eventually, I started to get a feel for what I wanted to say. So, I wanted to approach the Buddha as a human being. Yes, a human being. Someone who's grounded in history, grounded in society, but not to reduce him to that. I wanted to maintain a sense of the mystery of awakening that's at the heart of his identity. So, I wanted to see him as a forest renunciate. I reread Reginald Ray. A forest renunciate, but someone who's also at home speaking with kings, a man of wit, intelligence, kindness, as well as the grander sounding virtues of wisdom and compassion. I felt very pleased with myself. I did have something fresh to say about the Buddha. Then I reread the sections on the Buddha in the Survey of Buddhism and the Three Jewels, and I realized that this wonderful composite picture and my wonderful insights into the Buddha were all there, absolutely all of them, in Bante's writing 50 years ago. So that realization made me think about my desire to be original, which doubtless contains some vanity, and my desire to think for myself, which seems important. Now, I was thinking for myself, but I could see that my thoughts were deeply molded by Bante's. They arose in dependence upon Bante's thoughts. And this realization seems relevant to a birthday reflection on the Order, perhaps especially at a time when our sense of our shared identity is changing. So I want to reflect on a key part of that identity, our relationship to the Buddhist tradition, which also means reflecting on Bante, and eventually on the Buddha himself. It's much easier to do this sort of thing when Bhante isn't here, actually. I just mentioned that. One of Bhante's key teachings is his acceptance of the whole Buddhist tradition, as we know. The great figures of the major schools surround the Buddha on the refuge tree, and from them we draw our practices and liturgies. And yet, in my early days in the FWBO, I was schooled in the belief that we alone possessed a key to the future of Buddhism. Others might practice Buddhism in the West, but we, and we alone, practiced Western Buddhism. We had stripped the tradition of Asian culture, and we'd revivified its essential teachings within the culture of the modern world. And along with that went a degree of criticism of other Buddhist teachers and a degree of isolation, sometimes backed by explicit discouragement from studying or developing close contacts with other Buddhists. Personally, I found that constricting, and I've always thought that that is unhealthy for us as a movement. Things have changed. We're much less secluded, and it's not uncommon for order members to attend non-FWBO retreats, even study with other teachers. We're more aware of others' virtues, and we're also more aware of our limitations. In some ways, and this is the point of my talk, in some ways, I think this is a positive development. I think we do have much to learn from others, and I think I don't think we can do it all ourselves, and it raises the question of why we should try. But it's unsettling, this change. Losing an undue sense of your uniqueness is a sign, perhaps, of maturity, but it can also knock your confidence. If we aren't unique, if I'm not unique, who are we? Who am I? This change also brings risks, and this is the other point of my talk. We might maintain or even extend the open, inclusive aspect of Bhante's teachings, which accept the whole of the Buddhist tradition, but in the process lose the critical edge that's so central to his thought. In my view, the more we engage individually and collectively with other parts of the Buddhist world, the more important it is to retain that critical perspective. Our relationship to the Buddhist tradition may be a familiar topic, but I hope you agree that in the present context, it's worth revisiting. So let me start by offering a very, very simple map of Buddhism in the West. It's of my own devising, and in certain ways it's too simple to do justice to the reality, but it might help clarify this discussion. So let's say, firstly, we can talk about transplanted Buddhism. I'm going to use horticultural analogies. So transplanted Buddhism means the schools that have transplanted Theravada or Zen or Tibetan Buddhist schools or whatever from the soil of Asia and set it down here. Okay, transplanted Buddhism. Secondly, there are harvesters, people who want to harvest Buddhism as a resource from which Westerners can glean insights and practices. So those following this approach may meditate, they may practice mindfulness, they may engage with Buddhist art or symbols, but without being Buddhism or considering the Buddhist teachings as a whole. So this is a very broad brush, and these descriptions, I should emphasize, are not intended as criticisms. Transplanted Buddhism hasn't stayed still, and this is one of the things we're having to come to terms with. Westerners who follow Buddhist traditions with roots in Asia have also found ways to practice effectively and make their own cultural connections. Harvesting Buddhism for non-Buddhist ends is proving to be a dynamic and creative way of opening up at least some of what it has to offer the modern world. As a breathworks mindfulness trainer myself, I'm involved in doing exactly that. But while I appreciate the virtues of these approaches, it's important for us, I think, to be clear what distinguishes Bantes. So let us call this the seeding approach. He's wanted to take a seed of the great tree of Buddhism, of the Buddhist tradition as a whole, and replant it in the soil, in our case, of the West, or in other cases of India, or wherever else it might be. The seed is replanted, and then it can grow in the soil of that culture to create a new form that's suited to it. Transplanters, harvesters, and seeders. So as this talk is about the importance of preserving distinctions while remaining open to other Buddhists, in the limited time I have, I won't consider our relationship with transplanted Buddhism. So I won't be particularly talking about how the FWBO relates to or connects with Tibetan Buddhists or Theravada Buddhists and so on. The difference is actually usually quite apparent. Less straightforward is our relationship with the harvesters. And I want to explore this by discussing a book which expresses this approach at its strongest. So the book is by Joseph Goldstein, a well-known Vipassana teacher, and it's entitled One Dharma. So in other words, this is a book about the unity of Buddhism. And no less significant is its subtitle, The Emerging Western Buddhism. It might not be apparent that this is an example of harvesting, but let me explain. So this book, One Dharma, grows from Goldstein's personal spiritual journey. He trained in Theravadan meditation and co-founded the Insight Meditation Society in the United States. And since 1992, he's also practiced Dzogchen with Tibetan teachers. So this experience of practicing different traditions leads him to wonder if he can now really call himself a Theravadin. And what should he make of his Zen-trained friends who now practice, whose practice now includes Vipassana? So Goldstein's conclusion is that the categories of Asian Buddhism are collapsing as Westerners' practice cross-fertilizes. So this is an interesting development. He thinks this is the future of Western Buddhism. And this mingling of traditions does echo the FWBO's approach. But is it the same? So, the obvious danger in mixing traditions is superficiality. You take what suits you, leave aside what challenges you, and pay no attention to whether it all makes sense. So to avoid this, Goldstein believes that the key lies in the experience of Western practitioners like himself, who bring together in their own practice what he calls, this is a quote, the diversity and depth of the ancient Buddhist culture, and the openness and pragmatism of our contemporary Western culture. So the Dharma is a raft, and Goldstein says that in bringing together Buddhist pragmatism and its Western counterpart, he says, quote, we're giving birth to a skillful form for our times. Its defining characteristic is asking what works. What works to free the mind from suffering? What works to engender a heart of compassion? What works to awaken? Goldstein's approach favours experience over doctrine and intuition over clarity. And it fits the zeitgeist. Most people who turn to Buddhism are interested in changing themselves. We're all interested in changing ourselves, not so much in belief or philosophy or any of those sorts of things, and what could possibly be wrong with that. So Goldstein's approach harvests Buddhism by fitting it to personal, pragmatically felt needs, rather than to a coherence that's inherent in the tradition itself. So he's a harvester because he's drawing, his yardstick is his own personal spiritual experience. Okay, so let's compare that approach with Bantes. Now, Bante is no doubt all for experience and intuition, but he also believes that there's an underlying coherence to the Dharma, and he finds this in the basic teachings that underpin the tradition as a whole. However simple such teachings appear, he believes that they possess incalculable depths and can lead us to awakening. Goldstein would probably agree with that emphasis on basic teachings. But for Bante, this implies a hard edge, implies a critique of Buddhist schools, a transcendental critique, indeed critique of religion. We can ask whether the doctrines and practices of the schools conflict not just with one another, but with the values that are at the heart of the tradition. Now, words like clarity, critique, and even tradition aren't really part of the zeitgeist, but if you don't have them, you don't have Bante. What difference does this make? Goldstein identifies as the goals of Buddhist practice the qualities of wisdom, compassion, and mindfulness, because these are what speak to him pragmatically as the heart of his practice. He leaves out ethics, faith, energy, and samadhi in the sense of developing concentration, presumably because he has not, so far, felt them to be relevant. Now, there is much to value in Joseph Goldstein's approach, and personally I've got quite a lot of time for him, but I have learnt from Bante to value these other faculties and practices, and without them, frankly, much of my inner and outer life would be untouched by the Dharma, faculties and qualities such as ethics, faith, energy, and concentration. So being clear and valuing coherence, these unfashionable Sangharakshita-like qualities, this forces you to take account of important realities that you would otherwise avoid, and also to escape misunderstandings. So in the sutta that includes the parable of the raft, the Buddha also compares his teaching to a water snake. Unless you take care how you grasp the snake, the Buddha says, it will bite you. So you should hold down its neck with a cleft stick and grab its neck. Now that sounds more like Bante, doesn't it? There's another difference between Sangharakshita and Joseph Goldstein. If Goldstein's reference point is his own experience as an aspiring practitioner, Bante's introduces something else, which he sometimes calls the vertical dimension. As a way of approaching the large question of Sangharakshita's relationship to the transcendental, I turn to the third volume of his memoirs, where, picking up an image from Gnosticism, Bante tells us that in his 40s he felt like, quote, the alien whose true home is elsewhere, and who sojourns on earth as in a foreign land. His true home, Bante tells us, is a transcendental reality he touched age 16 when he read the Diamond Sutra. Now, it can't be easy to feel that you're an alien without feeling alienated. And no doubt this has brought difficulties. But since Bante was 16, I think that he has tried to stay true in all of his thinking, all of his writing, and his behaviour to his connection with this transcendental reality. He believed this not only his true home, but also the source of the transcendental unity of the Buddhist tradition. Bante draws on many branches of that tradition. While he doesn't claim to have mastered them all, he does say that he's explored them in the light of that insight. He ranges freely through Western culture to make connections, but he always resists reducing the Dharma to any other system of thought. As I see it, the hallmark of Bante's teaching is that he brings together the pragmatic perspective of the individual who struggles to live a life of awareness, authenticity, and conflicted humanity. Bring that together with the dimension that is represented by the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And this is why he emphasizes so strongly the centrality of going for refuge to the three jewels. This most basic of Buddhist formulae brings together the individual and the ideal. For us, it means bringing the three jewels into our lives and into the world. I offer three reflections at this point on the bearing of these thoughts to our current practice. The first concerns Bhante's stress that going for refuge is not just a teaching or a practice, it's an act. Notwithstanding the current vogue for talking about meditation as being rather than doing, early Buddhism is clear that all experience is action. The word translated as action is karma, and the defining characteristic of karma is intention. So every moment of conscious experience is a significant action in which we make moral choices between the skillful and the unskillful. To live is to act, and to act is to choose. No wonder Bhante is wary of the language of choiceless, or, dare I say it, pure awareness, which comes from later Buddhist discourse. His own teaching often stresses the importance of making choices, moral choices, that necessarily spring from impure awareness, and of acting from them. Going for refuge is the intentional act of coming into relationship with the boundless, liberating energy of wisdom and compassion that's represented by Buddhahood, and of sensing the challenges that offers our habitual ways of being, and of choosing a skillful response. My second reflection is to wonder if it might help to give Bhante's approach a name. Having been involved in instigating two unsuccessful attempts to change the name of the order, I'm not suggesting we try that again. But I've been starting to think of the FWBO's approach as Three Jewels Buddhism. Tri Ratna Buddhism, if you prefer. Try it out. Three Jewels Buddhism. See what you think. My third reflection returns us to the start of this talk. Not the joke about the rabbi, perhaps unfortunately, but to the Buddha. One of Bhante's teachings, which is important to me, but is perhaps a little neglected among us, concerns the centrality of the figure Shakyamuni Buddha and the man Siddhartha Gautama to our practice. His biography is the paradigm of this Buddhist spiritual life. He combines the human and the transcendental. He's a source of the tradition, and the scriptures that take us closest to him also offer the simplest version of those basic teachings that underpin the tradition as a whole. As Bhante repeatedly insists to us, we should study them. This is not to disparage the teachings or texts of later schools, but if we're to combine these with the visions of the earliest texts without lapsing into incoherence, we'll need the help of someone like Bhante and the combination of clarity and inspiration with which he draws on the tradition. I'm going to make a shameless plug now. Devan and I are doing a seminar on the life of the Buddha at Dharmapala College next in May, and you're all very welcome to come. Back to my talk. My own search for the Buddha, I recently went on pilgrimage to the holy places of India. When I arrived at Bodh Gaya with a group of fellow pilgrims, it rained torrentially. Thick rain that seeped into the huts where we slept the first night and buffeted us as we scurried from the Om Cafe to the Mahabodhi Temple, whose precincts include the Vajrasana, the Bodhi tree, and an array of stupas. As much for shelter as for inspiration, I sat all morning in the temple's main shrine room, and a stream of pilgrims passed through. Sri Lankan lay people chanting Pali verses shuffled behind their bhikkhus. Tibetan monks murmured sadhanas and counted their malas. And watchful Taiwanese nuns sat erect in their neat grey robes. On both this and my second visit, a couple of weeks later, when the rain had thankfully stopped, it seemed that in the precincts of the Mahabodhi Temple, we entered a space made sacred by the constant multivocal, multilingual, multi-denominational chanting, and by the meditation, prostrations, and pujas of pilgrims from across the Buddhist world. We weren't practicing together. At best, we were practicing in parallel. But as I sat in the temple and meditated, or tried to meditate, on the mind of the Buddha, I felt that we were peering together through a crack in the earth that opened into unending space. Such glimpses, I think, are not uncommon among us. Catching them and sustaining them is the point of sadhana and insight practice and puja, and something like them is at the heart of our ordination. Then comes the lifelong task of fleshing out those glimpses in the wholeness of our lives. The encouragement and guidance of Bhante's teaching may enable us to draw on the wealth of Dharma traditions as we engage with this task. And the clarity and profundity with which he expounds historical, doctrinal, and transcendental unity of the Dharma traditions is a distinctive contribution, one we should cherish, maintain, and pass on. This is Three Jewels Buddhism. For me, it means staying true among the perplexities of my life to the commitment I made at ordination when I went for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and to the mystery of awakening. It means remaining true while thinking for myself to what I have learned from my teacher, Dharma Master Urgyen Sangharakshita. Thank you.